may be on this fine day. Welcome to Observations. Kirk and I are here. Kirk, there was another bombing in a train in London, and Trump evidently said, you know, another loser terrorist. Okay, pal. 20-some-odd people were injured. You know, it was your backpack bomb, you know, filled with nails and all sorts of the things like that the Muslims like to put in them.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, all right. There are some times where you say, all right, I ought to be careful here and not jump to conclusions. But when you're dealing with a backpack bomb that kills innocent people, who are unknown to the assailant.
Mm-hmm. Has no other motive.
And it happens in a country like France or England, where there are a lot of Muslims, and they have been indoctrinated into hating everybody. The likelihood of it being perpetrated by a jihadist is probably in the 99 percentile. And so there are some times where you can say, okay, I don't know the name of the individual.
Yeah.
But I have witnessed enough of these to say that the likelihood is that the perpetrator is a jihadist. And to say that with 99% certainty, because when there is a crime like this, they perpetrate it 99% of the time.
If you were a terrorist, or you were using terror like the Irish did and so forth, back and forth, they usually have a political motive, and they usually state it. They want everybody to know.
Correct.
It.
Correct. But know? this is the jihadist way.
Yeah, that at least.
Yeah, this is the jihadist way. The other thing that was interesting to me today, you know, we've got another protest in St. Louis, tens of thousands of people out in the streets because another cop was essentially exonerated for killing a unarmed black motorist. And you know, I've seen the Black Lives Matter signs that I had a tough time with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I did is that I watched the aftermath of Irma. I don't know if you watched much of the news on Hurricane Irma as it went through the Caribbean islands and then through Florida.
As much as possible, yes, certainly.
Okay.
Relatives down there, so, yeah.
Yeah, I do as well. And so I was watching this, and there were looters again. And I watched the looters, both in the Miami area and then really sickening through St. Martin, where they were taking machetes and looting with machetes, killing anybody in their wake.
Really?
And guess what the race was of 100% of those running into stores pilfering $200 and $300 pairs of Nikes and flat screen televisions.
Well, I'm sure it's the same as it was in Los Angeles.
Same as it was in New Orleans.
In the Korean section, it was the black community. Yeah.
You really need to get your own house in order.
Yeah.
If you're going to start blaming somebody else for your problems. You know, the hurricane was devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were in a situation where there were no shelters available, there weren't billions of dollars of food and water being brought down and given away free. And they and their children were starving. Then breaking into a grocery store where much of the what's there is going to go bad anyway,
mm-hmm.
and taking wholesome kinds of foods to feed one's family, I'm going to give you a pass, even though there is that scenario is purely hypothetical because of the fact that there were shelters. There were plenty of time to go to the shelters. The shelters were wholly accommodating. You could get a ride to the shelter if you didn't have a vehicle. And the U.S. government had positioned billions of dollars worth of food and water.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't any reason to do that. But a flat-screen television? And top-of-the-line Nike tennis shoes?
Yeah.
Why are you stealing that? Why would you, at a time like this, when you really have an opportunity to do something positive for your neighbors, why would you be all giddy and run into stores and loot them? But I'm going to tell you, until you get your own house in order, stop pointing fingers. Black Lives Matter.
That's a fair analysis. Absolutely.
We were talking before the program began here just briefly as to where we should pick up today. And the debate is between going back to where we were on the 15th chapter of, or 14th chapter of Observations, which is a riveting review from God's perspective. It's a song that he is singing to his beloved and about a vineyard and that has been destroyed by religious types. And whether or not we go back to that today, we will return to it in this evening's program. Or do we go to something that is extraordinarily provocative? It's actually in the 6th chapter of Yeshayahu, so the 15th chapter of Observations for our time. Where God says something that is so contrary to religious sentiment, where he just says, you know, Isaiah said, you know, he wanted to go and communicate the word to his people, and you know, God's first of all saying, yeah, if you want, you really want to, you can go. You know, it's your call. I'm not going to tell you to go. You know, I've had it with him, but. You want to go, you can go. But if you go, what I want you to tell them is that they can look all they want, but they're not going to see. They can listen, but they're not going to hear. They can do these things, but they're not going to have the judgment to process any of it. And you wonder, why is God precluding people from knowing him?
Well, you know, we've had this discussion, Roy, and a bunch of the guys and ladies, we've all had these discussions on occasional group phone calls. And we all came to about the same conclusion that once he empowers us, and, well, you know, a malach, you can't get rid of them. All you can do is put them in a hole, in a black hole.
Right.
When he gives you that much power to be so close to like he is, that is an enormous thing for someone who's got the wrong attitude.
Correct.
I mean,
or has just enough knowledge to be in trouble. Yeah, or just enough knowledge to be a trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
what he's saying is, you know, eternity is a long time. Yeah, eternity is a long time. I don't know you well enough, and you don't know me well enough for you to be trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the last thing I want to do is to have to either spend eternity with you or to yank you out of my home in the midst of eternity and send you off to Sheol.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kirk, I would never have had the wherewithal to appreciate that. Until we had the eruption with Unpopular Truth and its cast of characters.
Everybody was part of the family, yes.
Right, and then the two Nimrods that grew out of it and created their own site became so anti-Yahweh and anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing how a little knowledge can be twisted and become so perverse in the mouths of people that just don't understand.
Yeah.
You know, my gut reaction, I mean, you read so many of my letters for both of these two, that my first inclination was to blame myself. And that is because even though, I mean, these books collectively are what, 16,000 pages.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's probably 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 hours worth of audio, but just on the audio shows, if you really weren't a reader But on the audio shows alone, if you listen to enough of them, it would be possible to be able to parrot all of the right things. To say, yeah, I was named correctly, to talk about the covenant, to talk about the conditions for participation, but not understand any of it, and still be slathered with either anti-Semitism or conspiracy or politics or religion or whatever was ailing the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And to give the impression that they know Yahweh, that they're part of the covenant, while at the same time they're promoting such vile rubbish, and their attitudes just stink.
Yeah.
And your first reaction is, oh my God, I don't want to spend eternity with such people. And then your second is, oh, am I responsible to some degree for making it possible for them to use God's terminology and speak of Him and use His name while in the same breath, saying things that are reprehensible and
mm-hmm.
delusional. And I think that's what Yahweh was trying to prevent here.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't hold yourself responsible. You know, I probably not on my email to you today, but I know in my notes in there when I didn't print it, but I read it off of your email. These chapters, but in there I made a little note to myself. I mean, gosh, where do we go from here? I mean, if we have to be, I don't know what's in these people's hearts, but do you not share? I mean, I've always told people, and I kind of concluded that if they're interested, if really, really interested, they're all in, and mm-hmm. you should be able to tell, although obviously we missed on a few people.
Yes.
But eventually they show themselves, but I don't know how you bridge that. I mean, what do you do? Do you just not share? I don't think so.
Yeah, no, it is a tough question. And yeah. There isn't an easy answer, which is why I think the answer that God provides is so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just read it here. We won't read it in a fully amplified fashion, but here is the sixth chapter of Yahshayah, Isaiah, opens. Now, keep in mind, the fifth chapter began as a love song. And then Yahweh was saying, and this is how you trashed my dream. This is how you trashed everything that I had hoped for, that I'd worked for. So it begins, in the year King Uzziah died, I saw my upright one, establishing a dwelling place before his seat of honor. He was engaged, raising and lifting up. The train of his majestic flowing garment filled the enduring, enabling, and empowering resonance. You know, there is a sizable difference, and I just keep on wanting to bring this out, between what we're doing and what Yahshayah was given the opportunity to do.
Well, he's inspired, and we're just reading the Torah.
Yes, we're reading what and thinking about what Yahweh revealed through him. But he was directly spoken to by Yahweh. But more than that, he's up in heaven.
Yeah.
I've come to know him through his words.
Yeah, wow.
He's up there in heaven. Yeah. There are some interesting parts of the statement, though, of course, is that you've got this contrast between the rich and powerful, the man with all of the wherewithal, the king, mm-hmm. King Uzziah, who, by the way, I think died with leprosy and completely alone because he was presumptuous, which is the nature of political types. He's dead. And here's Yahshayah now, the lowly prophet. Doesn't have any credentials other than God chose to work with him. He's up at the source of life. Nice contrast, I think.
Yeah.
When he goes up there, what does he see Yahweh engaged in? Establishing a dwelling place before, in the presence of his seat of honor. We've talked about this seat of honor before because it comes up quite a lot in Yahshayah. The seat of honor is the mercy seat. It's the Ark of the Covenant. We, this idea that Ron Wyatt found the Ark of the Covenant. directly beneath the place where Yosha served as the Pesach lamb, which is the buttress face of the edifice that becomes the buttress that becomes Mount Moriah. The summit of Mount Moriah is right above it, and this is essentially 777 steps from the most set apart spot of the temple, and it's right beneath where Yosha was crucified as the Pesach lamb that he found the Ark of the Covenant. And and it's exactly as you would expect, because he looked up, there was a crack from the earthquake that occurred almost 2,000 years ago, and that's where the blood of the Pesach lamb was sprinkled on the arm of the mercy seat. But that mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, is Yahweh's children's throne. It's where we have a seat of honor right before our Heavenly Father. And it has wings in the back because we're going to have wings. Now, not physical wings, but we're going to defy gravity, and we're going to be able to move very rapidly wherever we wish to go. It'll be as if we had wings. The only way to really demonstrate this concept for Yahshua, so that's how he was given the opportunity to see it. But that seat of honor is the Ark of the Covenant. It's not lost. It's right where it needs to be, and it's going to be deployed. And what was Yahweh doing? He was engaged raising his family and lifting them up. Now, the reason that the train of his flowing garment filled the enduring and enabling residence, and it's a residence, it's Shamayim, heaven, the spiritual realm, is a home. It's Yahweh's home, and therefore our home. The reason the majestic flowing garment filled it is because it needs to cover all of us. It's what empowers us and makes us perfect and makes us enduring. Mm-hmm. Now, it talks about here now that says the seraphim. A seraphim is a form of malach from above. And perhaps, you know, we know that seraphim can come to earth because they were guarding the walls of and gates of Eden. Mm-hmm. And they also spend time around Yahweh in his residence in the seventh dimension. But there's every reason to view the seraphim as a type of malach. The malachs are messengers. Seraphim from above approached him, having six bleached white wings, each one with two covering its presence, with two they concealed their feet, and with two they flew. So he's seen something unlike anything he's ever seen before, and he's trying to describe it using the best words available to him. Then they called out to one another, set apart. So what is the, you know, we've probably said this a thousand times, I'm not sure it has ever really resonated with most people. Yeah. But about the most important concept there is, in the totality of the Torah part, the prophets and Psalms is set apart.
Yeah.
The moment you understand set apart, you've got no longer do you have a fixation on the Christian Jesus. Even if you knew his name, you wouldn't care. You wouldn't, you know, I was talking to a guy last night, and he wanted to go to his Holy Spirit. And you wouldn't go to a Holy Spirit. You wouldn't have a Trinity. You would recognize that there is but one God. His name is Yahweh. And that Yosha is simply set apart from him. A diminished manifestation of him set apart from him. And it's the set apart spirit. So she's part of him, set apart from him, to fulfill her mission. Set apart is key, because it not only defines who Yosha is and who the set apart spirit is. Everything that's important to Yahweh is set apart.
Yeah.
Moriah is set apart.
The set apart place.
Right.
By the Egyptians.
Right. Jerusalem is set apart. Moriah is set apart. Zion is set apart. the home of Yahweh is set apart. The covenant family of Yahweh is set apart. The Torah is set apart. The seven meetings, the annual meetings with Yahweh are set apart. Everything that is important to God is set apart. His people are set apart. What does set apart mean? Well, if we are all part of humanity and we're living on this planet Earth, it means that to be important to Yahweh, to be valued by Yahweh, you must be set apart from those things. It's defining the initial requirement of the covenant, that you walk away from your country, from your father's home, from your societal influences. You must be set apart from those things. You can't be common. You can't be dependent upon and engaged with and allied to the family of man and human institutions and be part of God's family. So set apart works two ways. It says that Yahweh is set apart and everything important to him, including his covenant family, is set apart from the ordinary in our world. And by the way, what is more ordinary than religion? Isn't religion the most popular institution that man has ever devised?
From the shaman in the woods, in the jungle.
Yeah, yeah. And so you must be set apart from these things to be with Yahweh. You can't drag that trash into his home. And so it not only explains who Yahusha is and who the set-apart spirit is, it explains who Yahweh is, where he is, how all these things relate to him, and how we must be set apart if we wish to be with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it even explains the first requirement of the covenant. You need to walk away from these things to be set apart from them. So what's the first thing that they say? Set apart, set apart. If you understand set apart, you're so far along in the process of not only understanding Yahweh, but having the proper perspective on him, the proper perspective on the Torah, on the covenant, on the Mikra, on just life on this earth and the proper attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Proper approach, set apart. Completely, and this is interesting, completely prepared and exceedingly devoted is Yahweh of the spiritual implements. The entire material realm is filled, revealing a full measure of the abundance of his accomplishments and his importance, his manifestation of power, even his rewarding gifts and persona. I was writing the other day that it's extremely easy. I don't want to demean, what God did in terms of the creation of the universe, but from a perspective of a seven-dimensional being, talking the universe, material realm, into existence was easy for him. Now, it's mind-boggling for us because we don't even understand the four dimensions that we know about, much less five and six, and we most certainly can't have the perspective of what it's like to be in the seven dimensions and create a six-dimensional construct. But it is, I would say that it is as easy for God to have created the universe as it was for Walt Disney to have created the artificial world in two dimensions that mm-hmm. Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse operate in. Every bit as easy for God to create the universe. Now we're talking about the complex interaction between quarks and leptons and electrons and protons and neutrons and forming atoms, forming molecules, forming substances, this interchange between energy and matter, and ultimately expanding out so that it's 30 billion light years across with hundreds of billions of galaxies, each averaging hundreds of billions of stars. And to create that, both the small and the large, was no more difficult for him than was creating the environment for Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse or Walt Disney.
Well, they had to know how already.
Yeah. Now, what couldn't Walt Disney do with Donald Duck?
He couldn't interact with him.
Well, he couldn't interact with him.
Because he couldn't...
Well, that's true. Well, he couldn't interact with him. But there's something else that he couldn't do that he was anywhere close to being able to do. He couldn't make them live.
No. Yes, of course.
First of all, it's impossible for life to function in two dimensions. Life requires three dimensions even to function. But he couldn't make them live. Man has never been able to create life, much less complex life that can think, that can observe its environment, that can reproduce, that can respond in an intelligent way. My conclusion was, and it pertains to this particular statement, that the difficult task, even for God, was creating life, was creating that three-dimensional language of DNA and how it replicates through RNA, and then creating life in such a way that it would mirror his purpose, which is to create a family and have mankind understand the kind of family environment that he's trying to conceive. Creating life is much, much, much more difficult than creating a physical universe. Now, the physical universe has to be tuned for life, that's for sure. But when you just look at life, that alone is proof of the manifestation of his power and his accomplishments. You ought to recognize there was a creator as you see this universe. And you know, one of the things that was just so amazing about science is that about 95%, maybe more, of scientists 100 years ago were absolutely convinced, and you'd read in every textbook, they'd call you a moron if you didn't agree with them, that the universe was not created, that it always had been. And they took that view because they wanted to differentiate themselves from what they would call the biblical view of the universe being created.
Yeah.
And then Hubble discovered the redshift, that the universe is expanding, and that if it's expanding, that means that it had a point where it was conceived. And so with that proof, every scientist went to, well, the universe was created, and yet they didn't recognize, well, if it was created, it had a creator. And they can't figure it out. And they can't even figure out, as they, you know, look for the holy grail, if you will, of grand unification theories. You know, one of the reasons that we can't get beyond E equals MC squared, which unifies the energy and matter, and really come up with a grand unification theory, is that 95% of the universe is still unknown to us. 95%. I mean, yeah, we described this thing we've been studying for all of these years. We've written all these formulas, but the formulas only work with 5% of the universe. 95% of the universe completely eludes our understanding. And it's not just that we haven't figured out what it is yet. We call some of it dark matter and some of it dark energy. We don't even have the capacity to figure out what it is that we don't know. And this is not... Dark energy and dark matter, representing 95% of the universe, is beyond our ability to understand.
Yeah, can't do it.
And so, somewhere in there, we ought to have realized, well, we're dealing with, in all likelihood, dimensions again. Just as we couldn't understand the concepts of relativity until it was presented as a dimension and we could model it mathematically. I mean, Einstein was a mathematician. It was all modeled mathematically. And we realize that the only way to understand the universe is to add dimensions. But we haven't been able just to logically stand back far enough scientifically to say that just as we can create a two-dimensional realm easily, a four-dimensional entity can create a three-dimensional realm easily. So why don't we just back up and say, well, what would it take to create a six-dimensional realm, taking into consideration time as the fourth dimension, and then dark energy and dark matter as the fifth and sixth? Right. But it's obvious.
It has to be at least one more removed.
Yeah, it's obvious, but they don't want to think it through. And, of course, life is modeled after Yahweh's persona, particularly human life of men and women coming together as husband and wife, mother and father, conceiving and raising children in a family. It's a manifestation of his rewarding gifts and persona. It's a stunningly appropriate and thoughtful statement. The thresholds where the doors opened at the behest of the set-apart mother shook and swung open at the voice of the one who issued the invitation to be called out. And then the family home was filled with smoldering disappointment and enveloped in dissatisfaction. Kirk, you do a fair amount of translating, and I'm sure you've come across the same thing that I have. There are sentences where, in fact, the last two statements, they're very long statements that were in Yashaya towards the end of the seventh chapter. I translated the entire thing without even looking at a lexicon, just from the Hebrew. It's just, the words were common. I'd seen them so many times. It just, you know, here's what he just said. And there's other times where you can spend 5 hours and get through one statement.
Yeah.
This was one of the difficult ones, not the most difficult one, but you're just trying to figure out what is being presented here, because we're talking about word pictures. What is the word picture, and what are these words inferring? Well, the single most important part of the home of Yahweh, our home, the covenant home in the seventh dimension, in the spiritual realm, by far the most important from our perspective, for the doors. What will cause the doors to open? What will cause the doors to shut? And we know the answer to those things, but that's what Yahshayah was being shown, is that his word opens the doors. The doors opened at his word. And, of course, the doors opened at the behest of the set-apart mother. And she is our means to entering into Yahweh's home, because we have to be born of spirit. We have to be perfected. We have to be literally born from above spiritually, covered with her garment of light.
Well, you could also say about a Kodesh Kodesh or Yahusha,
yeah,
enabling it to be a door there by fulfilling Passover. So that's the first step in the Passover and the Matzah week.
Yeah, and I would go to that if it wasn't for the fact that, and maybe it still could be, because this door swung open to behest the one of the set-apart mother. So yeah, the Yahusha could be the door, and the set-apart mother is the one who is swinging it open. But it's the primary, there's two primary things to think about here that are vastly more important than that. Those are details. The big picture is the word of Yahweh will open those doors.
Right.
Do you want the doors open? Where's the key?
It's in the Torah and his word.
Yeah, that's right, the word of Yahweh. The second part is that when he opened the doors, he felt disappointment. It was smoldering dissatisfaction. And we're going to eventually get to this as we make our way through the seventh chapter of Yashaya. God's upset with us. He opened the door, and no one showed up. He opened the door to heaven, provided the means for us to get there. And
nobody came.
Cares. Nobody came. Here he opened the door to heaven to let souls in, and there was nobody.
That is just
to go through all of this, to create the universe, to author life, to provide us with his testimony through the Torah, to prove his existence through the prophets, to come up with this extraordinary plan on our behalf through the Mikre, and to serve as the means to enable that plan at great personal cost. And he opened the doors, and there's no one there.
Well, that's why your comment was correct. The one that I said was rather sobering.
Yes.
You know, because that absolutely personifies what he's thinking and what he felt. You know?
Yeah, what I said, if it wasn't for the promise he made.
If it weren't for his promises, he wouldn't even return.
That is correct.
I mean, that hit me rather, wow, right?
Yeah, this idea of him returning, he's only returning because he made a promise to Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob that he'd return and reconcile his relationship with their descendants, which is Yisrael and Yehuda. If it wasn't for that promise, he would not return.
Why would he get hit in the face all the time by this?
Oh, wow. But that is one of the most powerful messages in all of the prophets when you look at for what is being conveyed here. The thresholds of the door opened at the behest of the set-apart mother. They shook and swung open at the voice of the one who issued the invitation to be called out. The invitation to be called out are Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, Shavua, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah. He issued the invitation for us to come home through the doors open with his word, and no one was there. And heaven was filled with a disappointment and dissatisfaction. I responded and said, now this is Yeshaya speaking. I think had you and I been there, we would have responded the same way. Now, I wouldn't. Because right now at this moment, I would not feel sorry for me, and that's what Yeshaya is doing. He's saying, oh my God, this must be me that he's mad at. Now I'm so close to Yahweh, my response would be, oh, I feel so sorry for you, God.
Yeah, that's the appropriate one.
Yeah. So this is what Yeshaya said, and I'm not judging him here because...
No.
From his perspective, this is the appropriate response. It's not when you know what we know, and we know what we know because of what he revealed to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a better perspective, even though we're not there in the room with him, we have a better perspective of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what he said. So I responded and said, whoa, oh no, this distressful situation is because of me. For surely I'm ruined, and I'll be silenced because I'm an individual with unacceptable and unclean lips. And furthermore, I dwell in the midst of a people of unacceptable and unclean lips, except now. I have seen, I have looked upon, and considered with my eyes Yahweh of the heavenly messengers, the ultimate authority. So he's his reaction is the reaction I would have had a year ago. It's not the reaction I would have had 10 years ago. He was not concerned for his well-being. He knew Yahweh. He knew what he was offering. He knew where he stood with Yahweh. You know where you stand with Yahweh. You would never be concerned for your well-being in Yahweh's presence. Yeah. He wasn't concerned for his well-being.
Good no matter what.
Right. What he was concerned about is the same thing that I'm concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
From time to time. I think I've lost my concern to some degree over this just because...
Like, what have I done?
Yes, because of the because of the fact that there just aren't enough other people standing up saying I want to do this. So you get the opportunity by default, I think, and is humored by our peculiarities. So kind of more of a rascal you are, the more fun you are for him to work with, I think. But his concern was that he was going to be silenced.
Yeah.
He was serving as a prophet. A great job.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that's a better job or the job that we have, which is sharing what Yahweh conveyed through the prophets. I think they're equally good.
Same words, yeah.
Right. And losing that job was what he was concerned about. Not his well-being.
Yeah.
He loved being used.
That's what he loved to do, absolutely.
He loved being used by Yahweh. And that's what he was afraid of. My lips are unclean. My lips are unacceptable. Well, I'm not going to speak about yours, but I'll tell you mine are.
Oh, yeah. Don't be.
So he said God's displeased with me. And now I'm really in a pickle here because if he's done using me, he's displeased with me.
Yeah,
what am I going to do? I have actually seen with my own eyes.
I ain't going back to life.
So intense or gathering firewood. I mean,
where do you go from there?
This stuff is so real, so riveting, so genuine, so emotional. It's intellectual and emotional all at the same time. Then one of the seraphim flew toward me, and in his hand was a live ember, glowing on a decorative inlaid object, held in a pair of tongs. And it had obtained it from upon the altar. It reached out and extended it above my mouth. It said, "Behold, this has been extended to make contact near your lips, so removed, taken away, abolished, and no longer existing are your inadequacies, mistakes, and liabilities. Therefore, your offenses against the standard, your errors and mistakes, have been reconciled, pardoned by way of a ransom, and therefore annulled and forgiven." Do you think that this seraphim, which is a being comprised of light, required tongs to pick up something that was energy-based?
No.
So the tongs are there for Yashayah. Otherwise, he's going to be freaked out. Like, what in the world is happening? It's going to burn him. But no, all of this is visual imagery for the benefit of Yashayah. Do you think that Yashayah's lips were branded with this hot, burning object?
Of course not.
Did God torture him in heaven?
No. It tortures him anywhere.
Right. Is there a way that you could make your lips clean?
By burning them off?
No.
Not a good plan.
Yeah, are you going to be a more acceptable spokesperson your lips are? No.
No.
His lips weren't touched by this. This was all symbolic. This is the way that he saw it. I'm sure he saw it this way. But what's happening is that light and this glowing object is light. Light eliminates darkness. And so long as you are focused on the light, so long as Yahweh's light is abundant upon you, and particularly now on Yashayah's lips, doesn't matter. There's no darkness left there. His lips are now going to convey the light.
David, isn't it?
Right. His lips are going to convey the light.
Yeah.
That's the message here, is that, and what the whole purpose of this is to liberate Yashayah from anxiety. Just so he's free and relaxed.
Yeah.
Confident that I've got my inadequacies. I've got my flaws. But it doesn't matter. Not that Yahweh's got my back, he's got my mouth.
Yeah.
Then I listened And I heard the voice of my upright one asking, before I say what he asked, what is the thing that put Yeshayah in a position to respond appropriately?
Well, he understood. He understood.
Well, then I listened.
Oh, of course, Shama.
Yeah, I listened. That's the thing that nobody else seems to want to do. And the reason that, Kirk, you know, you and I are friends. We have a great relationship. But the reason you have this opportunity is the same reason I have it. I'm willing to listen to what God has to say. Not only willing to listen, I'm thrilled to listen to what God has to say.
Well, we dive right into it.
Yeah.
Great fun.
That's why Yeshayah. You know, I saw one of the war movies, and this idiot was saying, here I am, God, send me. You know, he was out fighting with his gun and everything else.
Yeah.
No. Unless you listen first, you're not in a position to speak for him. Then I listened, and I heard the voice of my upright one saying, whom shall I send? And who will go walking with us, toward us, and for us? There wasn't anyone else on the planet. Not one. Who shall we send? Who's willing to walk with us? Who's willing to go with us?
Among all these chosen people.
All these people.
And man.
So I answered and I proposed. This is the difference between Yeshayah and Azaz that we will see later. Achaz said, no, God, I don't want any of that stuff. No. You keep all your...
That's staggering to read that.
Keep it all to yourself. I don't want any of that stuff. Now, Yeshayah answered and responded, look, here I am, right here, right now, and I'm paying attention. Send me. Those eight statements. Those eight statements are simply setting up one of the most profound messages ever recorded. And yet, those eight sentences, if you take the time and study them, will stir you right to your core. Here I am. Right here. Right now. And I'm paying attention. Send me. Wow. He said, go, if you'd like. Progress, travel, walk about, if that is what you choose to do. Recognizing that it's your decision. You know, this Christian concept of we're all
command.
Sent, that we're commanded to what to...
Obey.
God, yeah. Well, this is so far beyond a command. This is God saying, I'm not asking you to go. I'm not telling you to go. I just asked a question. Who can we send? Who will walk with us and to us? And who can we send? I'm not asking you to go.
Yeah,
I'm not telling you to go.
No.
As a matter of fact, it was a rhetorical question, really.
Yes.
I just threw open the doors, and there was no one there. Oh, I communicated all this message through Moshe. I communicated it through Noah. I communicated through Abraham. I've communicated it, and I threw the doors open. There's no one there. Nobody wants to come in. I don't care if you go or not. I'm not asking you to go. So he says, it was written such that it's the imperative. The imperative is second person volition, the call stem. So, you know, if you'd really like to go, that's your choice. But what comes next? And say to these people, refuse to listen. But you will not make the necessary connections required to understand. You may choose to look, even stare, but you shall remain unaware and ignorant. Kirk, I don't think I could have processed that a year ago.
Well,
you know, I grew up in a Christian environment where God wants everyone to know Him. He wants everyone to be saved.
It's an opportunity.
Right. And here's God saying, I don't want you to know Me. Even if you want to read what I have to say, you're not going to understand it. You're not going to make the necessary connections to understand. You can look all you want. You can even stare. Ra-ah, ra-ah. You aren't going to see. You're going to remain unaware, ignorant. He doesn't want them to know Him.
That should make everybody shake in their boots.
Yeah. Wow. Now, out of context, you would say, oh, that's really mean. God doesn't want anybody to know Him.
No, it's not. If you don't give us think about something, then why should He? Why should He care about you?
I threw open the doors to heaven.
And you didn't show up.
And no one's there. Didn't show up. So, no. Look all you want now. You are not going to understand. You know, listen, if that's what you want to do. But you're not going to understand. Wow. And I think it's far more than I just don't want any part of these people. You know, not only did I invite them to spend eternity with Me as part of My family, and none of them showed up. So I don't want anything to do with them. I mean, just that alone is enough. But they did the worst possible thing. Rather than answering My invitation,
They went with the House of Dawn.
They're gallivanting with false gods.
Yeah.
Religion, politics, everything I told them not to do, they're doing. That's the reason we need to think of things in context. What do the first four chapters of Yeshaya tell us? Man is religious and God hates religion. That's what they tell us.
The whole theme is that, isn't it? I mean, it's religion and political leaders that have an army.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Military. I mean,
yes.
If you miss that, you ain't reading the Torah because it's all through it.
And in Yeshaya alone, it's, I wanted to raise you as My family. That was My goal. And yet you chose to be religious. And you chose to be political. And you chose to be militant. And so he went through and he talked about all of the societal influences, whether they be political, governmental, religious, societal, militaristic, and condemn them all. And it is in that context where he's saying, I don't want anything to do with you. I don't want you to know Me because I don't want to know you. I don't want you coming through that door.
Wow.
You know, and there's an old adage that that may have come from this statement. A little knowledge is dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's what we have here. You know, the person that says, hey, I can, I've read the book on flying an airplane. I'm going to get in the airplane and fly it. Get out of his way.
Yeah, don't ride with him.
Right. That's what we saw with the nasty Facebook social media flameouts that we've had to disassociate from. A little knowledge is dangerous. It's counterproductive.
This occurred to me probably the first or second year when I was reading Yada Yah initially through this second or third pass or whatever. And I said, you know, if you knew this, because I was thinking about religious preachers, if they really knew this, they'd be really dangerous.
Yes.
If they had that same attitude.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wrote as I was doing this.
You know, I forgot about it. that, but that occurred to me, and it kind of made me quiver a little bit, and I'm going, wow.
Yeah, right. It's one of the reasons I never invite a cleric to read this, ever.
Mm-hmm.
That's the worst possible thing. If they started the religious preaching and integrated Yahweh's name, and they started, you know, it's like the Hebrew Roots movement folks and the Messianics, where they try to blend the seven annual meetings together with Pauline Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Dangerous stuff.
Yeah.
And it's far more harmful, discrediting of Yahweh. You know, if you have a religion and your God is Jesus, that's certainly not damaging to Yahweh, because you don't even know what his name is.
Yeah.
But if all of a sudden it becomes Yosha, and you have him correctly presented as Torah observant,
mm-hmm.
and you start celebrating the Moed Mikre, but you're still viewing Paul's letters as scripture. Oh, man, you are screwed.
You are a dangerous Nephilim.
You are a dangerous dude. And so God's quite right in this.
Absolutely right on the money. I mean, of course, it's obvious.
It's what we ran into.
That's why.
Right.
It's like you can't have somebody in heaven that hates you.
It's why.
They have too much power.
It's why I made such a tremendous mistake with the with Unpopular Truth. That's why.
The good news is they don't understand it.
By including them.
They still don't understand it, just like he's talking about this king here.
Yeah, but by including them and then having them continue to promote fake news and conspiracy and politics and all manner of just disgusting lies in the artificial world of social media, but using Yahweh's name and the concepts that were been derived from these translations, I created a monster. And what God's saying is, that's what I'm trying to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want this to be easy. And it's a part of it, Kirk, is the realization that we really ought not go off script very often. You know, the spoken word is easy for people to identify with, and it doesn't take a lot of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And the written word's tough. Most people don't want to read. And I would say if you don't want to spend the time reading, you know, there's almost 20,000 pages here. If you don't want to spend the time reading it, then you ought not engage at all. Stop
worrying. I came to that conclusion a long time ago, you know, because we just noticed that the people that we talk to, a lot of them would actually listen to the show and get excited for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't want to read it, it just separates you really quick.
Right. And if you're not going to devote yourself to learning it and growing through it. Not fascinated with it and almost addicted to it. And I'm addicted to it.
Oh, yeah.
If you aren't addicted to it, if it isn't your
be addicted to.
Yeah, if it isn't your high, then you ought not trifle with it.
I totally agree.
Right. So this was an eye-opening experience for me, and it said that, and not surprising in this case, that my biggest concern is something that Yahweh is also concerned about. The difference is that I don't have the capability of knowing for certain that these people who are saying such awful things in the artificial world of social media mm-hmm. and violating the third statement that Yahweh etched in stone, using his way in a way that demeans it.
Yeah.
I mean, I can look at what they are saying, what Yahweh said is going to happen to these people, and come to the conclusion we're not going to have to spend eternity with them. But Yahweh's here telling us it ain't going to happen, because he gets much more definite as we move through this statement.